The paper also shilled for ubiquitous Acorn foreclosure victim Veronica Peterson of Columbia, Maryland, recycling uncritically her accusation that she'd been tricked into buying a $545,000 home by a broker who inflated her income and misrepresented her assets. These loans were weapons of mass destruction, the single mom of three and home daycare provider told the Post reporter on not being able to keep up with her mortgage bills. They destroyed our credit, our lives, and they blew up in our face. But a look at the court and real estate records exposed the truth. Edward Erickson Jr., a reporter for the independent Baltimore City paper, discovered that the victim, who took out a full mortgage with no down payment on a house she couldn't afford, looks more like a predatory borrower. Amazingly, Peterson lived in the home for more than a year without paying rent or mortgage. The online court and land records show that Peterson closed on the house on November 3, 2006, with two loans from Washington Mutual. The main mortgage, for $436,000, had a starting interest rate of 8.5%, adjusting in December. The second loan, often called a piggyback, totaled $109,000 with an interest rate of 11.25%. Those two payments together would have totaled $3,386.17 per month. That's before property taxes, upkeep, utilities, etc. Peterson would have to earn at least $50,000 per year just to make her house payments. The foreclosure was filed in July 2007. The balance on the main note then was $435,735.86, Erickson reported, plus unpaid interest and late fees, suggesting she made at most one payment on the house. Had she made all of her payments, Peterson would have spent about $64,335 so far. Had she rented a similar place, she would have been charged around $2,500 per month, a total of $47,500 since January 2007. Instead, she apparently paid nothing. These foreclosure con artists are just the tip of Acorn's fraudulent enterprises. The nonprofit Acorn, which takes in 40% of its revenues from American taxpayers after four decades on the public teat, has a long history of engaging in voter fraud, corporate shakedowns, partisan bullying, and pro-illegal immigration lobbying. This is the bread and butter work that Acorn does. President Obama knows it and appreciates it. He said so himself. Despite his numerous on-the-record remarks tying himself to Acorn over the years, candidate Obama asserted on its Fight the Smears campaign website that he never organized with Acorn. According to Acorn, however, Obama trained Chicago members in leadership seminars. In turn, Acorn volunteers worked on his campaigns. Obama also sat on the boards of the left-wing Woods Fund with Weather Underground terrorist Bill Ayers and Joyce Foundation, both of which poured money into Acorn's coffers. Acorn head Maud Hurd gushed that Obama is the candidate who best understands and can affect change on the issues Acorn cares about, like ensuring their massive government pipeline to your hard-earned money. Under the guise of consumer advocacy, Acorn has lined its pockets with both public and private money. The Department of Housing and Urban Development funds hundreds, if not thousands, of left-wing anti-poverty groups across the country, with Acorn as a leading recipient of the agency's subsidies. In October 2008, under the Bush administration, HUD announced more than $44 million in new housing counseling grants to over 400 state and local efforts. The Bush White House increased funding for housing counseling by 150% since 2001, despite the role most of these recipients play as activist satellites of the Democratic Party. The Acorn Housing Corporation received more than $1.6 million. Acorn is eligible for untold millions more in taxpayer funds from the $1 trillion stimulus package that President Obama signed into law in February 2009 and the $6 billion National Service Act passed the following month. Moreover, the Acorn Housing Corporation has worked to obtain mortgages for illegal aliens in partnership with Citibank. It relies on undocumented income, under-the-table money, which may not be reported to the Internal Revenue Service. Whistleblower documents reveal internal discussions among the group that blur the lines between its tax-exempt housing work and its aggressive electioneering activities. The group also targets corporate interests with relentless PR attacks and then enters no-lobby agreements with bullied corporations after receiving payment. The profound threat the group poses is not merely ideological or economic, it's electoral. In March 2009, the Obama White House made good on its promise to give Acorn a hand in shaping the administration's agenda when it designated the group an official partner of the U.S. Census Bureau. President Obama has entrusted Acorn, infamous for voter fraud scandals spanning more than a decade, to assist with the recruitment of the 1.4 million temporary workers needed to go door-to-door to count every person in the United States. At first, the administration denied that Acorn would play a substantial role in the census process. But documents obtained by Washington, D.C.-based watchdog Judicial Watch revealed in May 2009 that the Census Bureau offered Acorn the opportunity to recruit census workers who would participate in the count. Moreover, as an executive-level partner, Acorn has the ability to organize and/or serve as a member on a complete count committee, which, according to census documents, helps develop and implement locally based outreach and recruitment campaigns. What could possibly go wrong? See no embezzlement, hear no embezzlement, speak no embezzlement. At the intersection of the SEIU and Acorn stands Wade Rathke. The New Orleans-based activist was the founder of SEIU's Local 100 chapter in Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas, which represented hotel workers. He also launched a social justice initiative in Arkansas that would become the mega umbrella conglomerate of community organizers known today as Acorn. After 38 years, the association now claims more than 400,000 dues-paying members with more than 1,200 chapters across the country. On his website, Rathke bills himself as a lifelong progressive who has been dedicated to winning social justice, workers' rights, and a democracy over the last 40 years, where the people shall rule. Rathke recently became chief organizer of Acorn International, which now operates in Canada, Peru, Mexico, Argentina, Dominican Republic, and India, along with emerging projects in Kenya and Ecuador, and partnerships in Indonesia, Korea, and the Philippines. Like so many of his foot soldiers breaking into homes and registering cartoon characters to vote, Acorn's founder isn't telling the whole truth. His do-gooder image is a far cry from the ugly reality exposed not by right-wing radio or Republican Party operatives, as might be expected, but by internal Acorn whistleblowers themselves, disgusted with the corrupt organization. In June 2008, Rathke was forced to step down from the powerhouse association he founded. A month later, the New York Times, in a rare bit of investigative journalism against a left-wing sacred cow, exposed Acorn's dirty laundry, prolonged cover-up, and complicated network of pass-through organizations. Reporter Stephanie Strom boiled it down. Acorn chose to treat the embezzlement of nearly $1 million 8 years ago as an internal matter and did not even notify its board. A whistleblower forced Acorn to disclose the embezzlement, which involved the brother of the organization's founder, Wade Rathke. The brother, Dale Rathke, embezzled nearly $1 million from Acorn and affiliated charitable organizations in 1999 and 2000, Acorn officials said, but a small group of executives decided to keep the information from almost all of the group's board members and not to alert law enforcement. Dale Rathke remained on Acorn's payroll until a month ago, when disclosure of his theft by foundations and other donors forced the organization to dismiss him. Rathke admitted he suppressed disclosure of his brother's massive theft, first discovered in 2000, because word of the embezzlement would have put a weapon into the hands of enemies of Acorn. In other words, the protection of Acorn's political viability came before protection of members' dues and taxpayers' funds. Rathke's supporters on Acorn's board helped cover up the crime by carrying the amount his brother embezzled, $948,607.50, as a loan on the books of Citizens Consulting Incorporated. CCI, the accounting and financial management arm of Acorn, and its complex web of affiliates, is housed in the same building as the National Acorn headquarters in New Orleans. It's also home to Acorn International, which Wade Rathke continues to head. Acorn Brass cooked up a restitution plan to allow the Rathkes to pay back a measly $30,000 a year in exchange for secrecy about the deal. Dale Rathke kept his job and his $38,000 annual salary until the story leaked to donors and board members outside the Rathke circle. A close friend and benefactor of the Rathkes, ultra-liberal philanthropist Drummond Pike, volunteered to foot the rest of the bill for the embezzled funds by buying a promissory note worth $800,000. Pike founded the Radical Tides Foundation, a key Acorn donor which bills itself as committed to positive social change. Wade Rathke sits on the Tides Foundation board of directors. Acorn whistleblowers, disgusted with the cozy cover-up, again spilled the beans to the New York Times. Mr. Pike refused to confirm or deny that he had bought the note. "As a rule, I do not comment on my personal finances," he wrote in email messages in answer to questions about the deal. But email messages among Acorn's senior executives discuss how to keep Mr. Pike's identity secret, even as they acknowledge that some of the foundations and philanthropic advisors that have supported Acorn and its affiliates know that he bought the note. "Does Drummond know the word is out?" Stephen Kest, the executive director of Acorn, wrote on July 4th. "If not, shouldn't someone tell him?" In a July 12th email message to Mr. Kest, Acorn's political director, Zach Pollitt, wrote, "I talked to Drummond on this yesterday and had Beth Kingsley, Acorn's lawyer, prepare a keep your yap shut confidentiality memo to people at Acorn and CCI." Fortunately, the keep your yap shut memo didn't stop the whistleblowers from going public with even more damning disclosures. In June 2008, Acorn National Board members Karen Inman and Marcel Reed were appointed to a special committee assigned to investigate the Rathke debacle. They took the task seriously. Too seriously for the Acorn whitewashers' comfort. In September 2008, the two filed a petition for access to financial data related to the embezzlement. Inman and Reed, leading a group of 25 Acorn members who signed on to the complaint, charged that Rathke's henchmen at Acorn were destroying key documents. Rathke continued to meddle with employees and meet with staff members regarding his brother's financial shenanigans, the dissident said. Moreover, Inman and Reed discovered the amount Rathke embezzled may have exceeded the $1 million first reported. Reed urged his colleagues to resist the Acorn culture of quiescence to Wade Rathke and his family so that Acorn vindicates the poor and moderate income people it represents. In November 2008, the Acorn Executive Board responded by firing Inman and Reed and dismissing them from all Acorn duties. Those who helped cover for the Rathkes, however, kept their jobs. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Oh, what a tangled web. As internal turmoil rattled Acorn's front office, Barack Obama's campaign was forced to admit in the summer of 2008 that it had filed misleading reports on its dealings with Acorn's Get Out the Vote arm, Citizens Services Incorporated. The nonprofit group is housed in the same New Orleans compound as Acorn, Acorn International, SEIU Local 100, founded by Wade Rathke, and CCI, the bookkeeping arm that hid Dale Rathke's embezzlement. Citizen Services was established in December 2004 to assist persons and organizations who advance the interests of low and moderate income people, according to paperwork filed in Louisiana. In a 2006 Acorn publication, Citizen Services Incorporated is described as Acorn's campaign services entity. But its executive vice president, Jeff Robinson, insisted that it was a separate organization entirely from Acorn. In August 2008, the Obama campaign disclosed that it had paid more than $800,000 to CSI and misrepresented the expenditures. Federal Election Commission reports show that from February to May 2008, Obama paid $832,598.29 to CSI for the following services: $310,441.20, February 25th, 2008, staging, sound, lighting; $160,689.40, February 27th, 08, staging, sound, lighting; $98,451.20, February 29th, 08, travel, lodging; $74,578.01, March 13th, 08, staging, sound, lighting; $18,417, March 28th, 08, polling; $18,633.60, April 29th, 08, staging, sound, lighting; $63,000, April 29th, 08, advance work; $105.84, May 2nd, 08, license fees; $75,000, May 17th, 08, advance work; $13,176.20, May 17th, 08, per diem. The Obama campaign tried to shrug off the false campaign finance filing as a run-of-the-mill clerical error, but the campaign's explanation didn't pass the sniff test. All of this just seems like an awful lot of money and time spent on political campaigning for an organization that purports to exist to help low-income consumers, Jim Terry, chief public advocate for the Washington, D.C.-based Consumer Rights League, told the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Acorn has a long and sordid history of employing convoluted Enron-style accounting to illegally use taxpayer funds for their own political gain, Terry claimed. Now it looks like Acorn is using the same type of convoluted accounting scheme for Obama's political gain. Indeed, there's much more to the story of Obama's amended campaign finance reports than Team Obama let on. CSI appears to have been a front to funnel payments to Acorn for campaign advance work. This same Acorn offshoot was the subject of a little-notice complaint to the FEC by a Democrat who smelled something rotten going on between CSI, Acorn, and yet another left-wing tax-exempt political advocacy group, Communities Voting Together, CVT. Former Maryland Democrat Congressman L. Wynn filed an FEC complaint in January 2008, linking several suspicious outfits used by his primary opponent, Donna Edwards, to one address in New Orleans. In a letter to the FEC, Laurie Sherwood, Wynn's campaign manager, wrote, "Based on my examination of various records and documents, I believe the Donna Edwards for Congress committee has received substantial assistance by way of unreported, in-kind contributions from organizations who profess to have operated independently of the Edwards campaign." In a 134-page complaint, Sherwood alleged that as executive director of the ARCA Foundation, a social justice organization, Edwards was responsible for administering and overseeing grants that are awarded and distributed by the group, grants that went to some of her campaign's biggest supporters. Nearly 40 ARCA Foundation grant recipients contributed $75,000 to Edwards' campaign, including monies from board members and employees, Sherwood reported. Moreover, she noted that the tax-exempt political advocacy group, Communities Voting Together, CVT, which distributed thousands of anti-Wynn flyers, is located at 1024 Elysian Fields in New Orleans, which also happens to be the address for Wade Rathke's SEIU Local 100, Acorn, CSI, and CCI. Wade Rathke, president of Elysian Fields Corporation, is also the chief organizer for SEIU Local 100, founder of Acorn, and a member of the board of directors of Tides Center and Tides Foundation, Sherwood pointed out. Tides received $245,000 in grant money from Edwards' ARCA Foundation from 2002 to 2006. More connections. Donna Farr is the custodian of record for Communities Voting Together, the assistant treasurer for Acorn, and deputy treasurer for the American Institute for Social Justice and Voting for America, Incorporated. Both of these organizations received a combined total of $230,000 in grants from ARCA between 2003 and 2006. Enter CSI again. I learned that Citizen Services Incorporated qualified to do business in Maryland as a foreign corporation and gave a registered agent address of 11 East Chase Street in Baltimore, Sherwood wrote. After checking to verify the address, Sherwood discovered no record of CSI actually having an office in Baltimore. CSI had forfeited its license to do business in Maryland 2 months after the 2006 primary election. Yet the Edwards campaign paid CSI $76,866.80 in three separate payments, all purportedly for door-to-door get-out-the-vote activities. Sherwood tracked the payments to an Acorn office address in Baltimore. She concluded, "The efforts of these well-heeled groups in promoting the Edwards campaign raise serious questions about the involvement of corporations which have applied for and sought not-for-profit status but are receiving monies from a candidate for services. At the same time, these groups are actively engaged in a coordinated effort to assist the Edwards campaign. That assistance is not reflected in campaign finance reports, which may violate federal reporting requirements." Edwards defeated Wynn. In the fall of 2008, the Federal Election Commission ruled that there was no reason to believe that the Edwards campaign violated campaign finance rules. But there is at least one other example of suspiciously large payments to Citizen Services Incorporated that calls into question what kind of work this purportedly nonpartisan, nonprofit offshoot of Acorn is doing. In February 2009, liberal group Ohio Citizen Action reported a $907,808 payment to Citizens Services for canvassing and $590,526.10 for campaign consulting. That's some gold-plated get-out-the-vote and consulting services right there. The scheme is all the appearances of another left-wing slush fund for Democrat satellites exploiting nonprofit status and skirting campaign finance laws. Acorn's own internal review of shady money transfers among its web of affiliates underscores the concern. A June 2008 report by lawyer Elizabeth Kingsley raised red flags about the incestuous relationship between Acorn and Project Vote, the offshoot Barack Obama worked for and insisted was completely separate from Acorn. Project Vote, a 501c3 organization, was founded by left-wing lawyer Sandy Newman to register voters in welfare offices and unemployment lines with the explicit goal of turning back the Reagan Revolution. In 1992, Newman hired Obama to lead Project Vote efforts in Illinois. The Illinois Drive's motto, "It's a power thing." Despite his adamant denials of any association with the group, his Fight the Smears website claimed Barack Obama never organized with Acorn. Obama's political DNA is encoded with the Acorn agenda. The Obama campaign's Vote for Change registration drive, running in conjunction with Acorn Project Vote, was an all-out scramble to scrape up every last unregistered voter sympathetic to Obama's big government vision. Kingsley's internal review found inextricable links between Acorn and Project Vote. Project Vote hires Acorn to do voter registration work on its behalf, and the two groups say they have registered 1.3 million voters this year. As a federally tax-exempt charity, Project Vote is subject to prohibitions on partisan political activity. But Acorn, which is a nonprofit membership corporation under Louisiana law, though subject to federal taxation, is not bound by the same restrictions. Ms. Kingsley found that the tight relationship between Project Vote and Acorn made it impossible to document that Project Vote's money had been used in a strictly nonpartisan manner. Until the embezzlement scandal broke last summer, Project Vote's board was made up entirely of Acorn staff members and Acorn members. Ms. Kingsley's report raised concerns not only about a lack of documentation to demonstrate that no charitable money was used for political activities, but also about which organization controlled strategic decisions. She wrote that the same people appeared to be deciding which regions to focus on for increased voter engagement for Acorn and Project Vote. Zach Pollitt, for instance, was Project Vote's executive director and Acorn's political director until July, when he relinquished the former title. Mr. Pollitt continues to work as a consultant for Project Vote through another Acorn affiliate. As a result, we may not be able to prove that 501c3 resources are not being directed to specific regions based on impermissible partisan considerations, Ms. Kingsley said, referring to the section of the tax code concerning rules for charities. Project Vote, for example, had only one independent director since it received a federal tax exemption in 1994, and he was on the board for less than 2 years, its tax forms show. Since then, the board has consisted of Acorn staff members and two Acorn members who pay monthly dues. Moreover, as the Consumers' Rights League has documented, Acorn posted job ads for Citizen Services. Communities Voting Together has contributed $60,000 to Citizen Services Incorporated. Project Vote has hired Acorn and CSI as its highest-paid contractors, paying Acorn $4,649,037 in 2006 and CSI $779,016 in 2006. Acorn, investigative journalist Matthew Badum joked, moves money around its network with a boldness and agility that Pablo Escobar would have admired. With equal deftness, Acorn avoids taxes with the boldness and agility of any given tax cheat serving in the Obama administration. Tax evaders are us. Vadim traced more than 200 federal, state, and local tax liens to Acorn's office compound in New Orleans. The debt totaled more than $3 million since 2005. Yes, the White House has entrusted the same organization that can't bother to keep track of its taxes to gather and report accurate census data. Muscle for money. One of Acorn's most outspoken critics and former employees is Anita Moncrief, fired from her Washington, D.C. strategic research writing position in January 2008 for using a Project Vote credit card for personal expenses worth less than $2,000. She served as the primary source for the rare investigative forays by the New York Times into Acorn's fraudulent empire. In sworn testimony for a lawsuit filed by the Pennsylvania Republican Party against Acorn, as detailed by Ballotpedia, Moncrief, an Obama supporter, revealed how Acorn's quality control efforts were minimal or non-existent. The quality control policies of Acorn were largely window dressing. Acorn knew that most new voter registration forms it had gathered were fraudulent. When she was employed by the organization, it was given lists of potential donors by several Democratic presidential campaigns, including that of Barack Obama. In November of 2007, Acorn's Project Vote Development Director, Karen Gillette, told her that Gillette had direct contact with the Obama campaign and had obtained their donor lists. Ms. Moncrief also testified she was given a spreadsheet to use in cultivating Obama donors who had maxed out on donations to the candidate but who could contribute to voter registration efforts. Project Vote calls the allegation absolutely false. Internally, Acorn had a policy of cooperating with authorities in prosecuting those who got caught trying to falsify registration forms, a policy referred to by staffers as throwing them under the bus. Moncrief's testimony was backed by other former Acorn employees. "There's no quality control on purpose, no checks and balances," former California Acorn organizer Nate Toler told the Wall Street Journal's John Fund. Gregory Hall, a former Acorn employee, told Fund he was instructed on his first day in 2006 to engage in deceptive fundraising tactics. At congressional hearings in March 2009, Moncrief's lawyer, Heather Heidelbo, further outlined how Acorn would bully companies into providing donations through aggressive protests. The program was referred to as Muscle for Money. Acorn had official and unofficial programs called Muscle for the Money. The first program, the official program, is the marketing name Acorn gives for its voter registration drives. Citizen Services Incorporated, CSI, an affiliate of Acorn, prices the cost to register a voter, drive the voter to the poll, and eventually get the voter to vote. CSI does the voter identification, turnout, and get out the vote. Acorn CSI markets its program to candidate or campaigns and sells their services by stating that if you use the program with their proven methodologies, they will get it done at a certain price. CSI worked with Acorn and Project Vote. All the affiliate organizations worked together. Ms. Moncrief testified about a document she had access to. It talks about America Votes and some notes from a meeting that took place, I would say. The document states under political money rules, we prefer that political money go to us in the form of a vendor, which would be CSI, our for-profit business, which does not have to report the cash because it's a business, like the phone company. The second unofficial Muscle for the Money program is a corporate-directed program for donations. Ms. Moncrief testified, that program is what I learned in the local offices. That's where, let's say, the D.C. office where I was. They would be given a project to go work on, even if they didn't have interest in it. All the time, even after I was fired, I was working with Acorn, going to barbecues, doing other stuff with D.C. local. They got involved with a group called the Carlyle Group. They were paid by SEIU to harass a man named Mr. Rubenstein. And they wanted me to go out, the D.C. local did, wanted me to go out and break up a banquet dinner, protest out in front of his house. But the local, D.C. local, did not have an invested interest, really, in messing with the Carlyle Group. It was because they were paid by SEIU to do this. And it was always referred to as Muscle for Money because they would go out there, intimidate these people, protest. They did it in front of Sherwin-Williams. They did it at H&R Block, where H&R Block was a target for years. And instead of, you know, reforming the way they did the rapid anticipation loans, they ended up giving money to the Acorn tax sites, which paid for new computers and money to run these tax filing sites around the country. The protesting was used to get companies to negotiate. The companies would pay money to get the protesting to stop. In addition to calling this activity Muscle for the Money, the insiders at Acorn called it protection. Ms. Moncrief testified, protection. We were, not to be flippant, but we were just always very sarcastic about it in the offices. We knew what was going on, and it's not that we thought it was funny. It was just one of those things that we talked about. A few weeks later, Acorn flexed that muscle again by busing dozens of its radical activists to the private homes of AIG executives targeted because they accepted taxpayer-subsidized retention bonuses.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
The overwhelming evidence of Acorn's racketeering and corruption persuaded one of the organization's fiercest defenders to change course, if ever so briefly. Democrat Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, signaled his desire in April 2009 to pursue hearings on Acorn's mob tactics. Defying fellow Democrats' crying right-wing smear job, Conyers pushed for further investigation into Heidelboe and Moncrief's allegations. But by early May 2009, Conyers had retreated. On the day he announced publicly that there would be no probe, Nevada Democrat officials unveiled a whopping 39 felony charges against Acorn related to voter registration fraud. Fortunately, Conyers' cowardice did not quiet Acorn's critics, nor did the attempt by the New York Times to stifle the growing controversy over the organization's vast interlocking network and the Obama campaign's involvement in it. In response to congressional testimony by Pennsylvania lawyer Heather Heidelboe, alleging that the Times had killed a game-changer story on how Team Obama had shared donor lists with Project Vote, the newspaper's ombudsman, Clark Hoyt, dismissed it as the tip that didn't pan out. Hoyt airily dismissed the charges by Acorn whistleblower Anita Moncrief as nonsense and quoted a Times editor who shrugged, "You have to cut bait after a while." It was an all-too-convenient judgment that just happened to be made as Election Day loomed. Contrast this with the editorial doggedness of the Times' editors in pursuing and publishing the Star magazine quality insinuations that GOP presidential candidate John McCain had carried on an affair with Washington lobbyist Vicky Eisman. Hoyt attempted to paint Moncrief as an unreliable source. But Times reporter Stephanie Strom had happily relied on her for months to break a series of Acorn corruption stories. And email messages from Strom show not only the New York Times reporter's repeated praise and gratitude for Moncrief's information, but also her concurrence with Moncrief's assessment of the vast money-funneling Acorn enterprise. On July 10, 2008, Strom wrote to Moncrief, "I'm a little miffed with the funders, too. They have to be aware that the grants they make to C3s, like Project Vote, are being funneled to Acorn, which, whether C4 or simply nonprofit corporation under state law, they aren't supposed to give money to." On July 31, 2008, she wrote, "I really want to see 1024 Elysian Fields in New Orleans. It's the official home of something like 50-plus Acorn-related entities. The real story to all this is how these myriad entities allow them to shuffle money around so much that no one really knows what's getting spent on what. And for the charities, like the housing orgs, that's a problem. Charitable money cannot be spent on political activities. It's a big no-no that can cost organizations their exemptions." Later that same day, she wrote, "You are a gold mine." On September 7th, 2008, after Moncrief alerted Strom to my reporting on the Acorn CSI Obama campaign ties, Strom replied, "I'm also onto the Obama connection, sadly. Would love the donor lists. As for helping the Repubs, they're already onto this like white on rice. Sigh." On October 6, 2008, Strom told Moncrief about her nasty run-in with the Obama campaign. "I'm calling a halt to my efforts. I just had two unpleasant calls with the Obama campaign wherein the spokesman was screaming and yelling and cursing me, calling me a right-wing nut and a conspiracy theorist and everything else. I'd still like to get that file from you when you have a chance to send it. One of these days, the truth is going to come out." Critics suggested that the donor lists could have been compiled through public records, but I obtained the lists, not only of Obama donors, but also lists of Democratic National Committee, Hillary Clinton, and John Kerry contributors. The records include small donors to the Obama campaign who are not disclosed in public campaign finance databases. It's information only a campaign could supply. Moncrief testified under oath last fall that her then-boss, Karen Gillette, gave her the Obama donor list and told her the campaign had furnished it. Moreover, email between Acorn, Project Vote, and CSI make explicit references to working on Obama campaign-related projects. The list of maxed-out Obama donors is explicitly mentioned in staff email. Another message from Acorn Project Vote official Nathan Henderson James warns Acorn and affiliated staff to prepare for conservatives gearing up a major Oppo research project on Obama. Henderson James wrote, obligatorily, understand I'm not suggesting that we gear up to defend a candidate's campaign, but that, of course, is exactly what the Acorn Network did. A few Republican lawmakers have begun to grasp the enormity and significance of Acorn's coordinated political corruption. Minnesota GOP Representative Michelle Bachmann called on Congress to block federal housing funds for the group in the wake of the Nevada felony voter fraud case. Iowa GOP Representative Steve King renewed efforts to launch a congressional probe into Acorn's finances. He told the American Spectator, this spiderweb, this myriad web of Acorn dollars and revenue streams, every bit of them should be looked at. All the corporations that they are networked with, all of the boards of directors of those corporations, the interlocking, connecting, the faces that are the same from board to board. And on May 29, 2009, constitutional lawyer and former Bush administration official Kris Kobach entered the race for Kansas Secretary of State, citing Obama's favorite radical left-wing racket as his primary motivation. Kobach distilled the essence of the vast web of its partnerships. Acorn is a criminal enterprise. For its part, the Obama White House has remained tight-lipped. Like the mafia, Acorn has its own golden rule of omerta, the code of silence among criminals. It's a language the Clinton mob is well-versed in, too. Chapter 9. The Clintons. Two for the price of one. Cameras clicked and reporters scribbled as the wife of Bill Clinton picked up a dainty mint-colored gift box and grinned from ear to ear. Standing next to her was Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Mrs. Clinton, on behalf of her bitter rival and now boss, Barack Obama, grandiosely presented her little gift to Lavrov. As she untied the matching bow, Secretary of State Clinton explained that the mysterious item symbolized what she and Obama wished for U.S.-Russian relations. Lavrov watched as Clinton pulled out a big red button on a yellow and black base with a Russian word painted on it. We want to reset our relationship, she proudly declared. Clinton placed her hand over Lavrov's, and they jointly pressed the button for the carefully planned photo op. We worked hard to get the right Russian word, she told Lavrov, as camera bulbs continued to flash. Do you think we got it? Niet. Hillary's little gift turned out to be a big blunder. Lavrov politely broke the awkward news as Mrs. Clinton's smile froze. You got it wrong, Lavrov said, as he pointed to the button's base. This says Petrogrutska, which means overcharged. Forced laughter ensued as smart power, the name Mrs. Clinton humbly gave her diplomatic philosophy to restore America's standing in the world, turned into an international bad joke. Too bad the American people can't hit the reset button on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's appointment. It's only a matter of time before her gaffe with the Russians is overshadowed by far more serious problems. Mrs. Clinton's Democrat Senate colleague and fellow failed presidential candidate John Kerry praised her as extraordinarily capable and smart, an individual with a global stature and influence to help shape events. Capable? Smart? Debatable at best. But there's certainly no question she has used her considerable influence, derived largely from her hubby's presidential prestige, to help shape favorable public policies for deep-pocketed donors at home and abroad. There is barely an oligarch, royal family, or special interest group anywhere in the world that does not know how to get the former president's attention, journalist Christopher Hitchens joked. With Mrs. Clinton in command of Foggy Bottom, the conflicts are no laughing matter. Pay to play is the Clinton way. Republicans made token noises over the Clintons' ethical morass. But ultimately, only two GOP senators voted against their colleagues' confirmation, Senators Jim DeMint of South Carolina and David Vitter of Louisiana. One of Mrs. Clinton's most vocal Republican defenders, ethics crusader John McCain, who used his first Senate floor speech since the end of his presidential campaign to push for his good friend's speedy approval. I think the message that the American people are sending us now is they want us to work together and get to work. I think we ought to let Senator Clinton, who is obviously qualified and obviously will serve, get to work immediately. McCain, the Senate's loudest critic of earmarks, saw no problem elevating his dear pal to the nation's highest diplomatic post, despite her obvious penchant for influence peddling. Never mind that Mrs. Clinton requested nearly $2.3 billion in porky federal earmarks for 2009, nearly triple the largest amount received by any other senator the previous year. Never mind that since taking office in 2001, Clinton delivered $500 million in earmarks to 59 corporations, roughly 64% of which provided funds to her campaign through donations made by employees, executives, board members, or lobbyists, according to the Los Angeles Times. Never mind that while she shoveled out taxpayer funds to campaign contributors, her hubby was raking in dough from foreign leaders and tycoons to the tune of at least $46 million. How could Hillary's Republican cheerleaders be so recklessly tolerant of business as usual at this level of government? Favor trading at home jeopardizes Americans' wallets. Favor trading abroad puts American sovereignty and security at risk. The stakes are high. Shouldn't the standards be, too? Liar, liar, pantsuit on fire. Mrs. Clinton promised not to let her husband's financial dealings sway her decisions as Secretary of State, but those who take the Clintons at their word haven't been paying attention to the last two decades. Whitewater, Travelgate, Chinagate, Pardongate, Lewinsky-gate, Healthcare Task Force-gate. Is there a pair of politicians any less deserving of the benefit of the doubt than Bill and Hillary Clinton? Seeking to burnish her foreign policy leadership credentials during the presidential campaign, Senator Clinton repeatedly peddled a harrowing anecdote about dodging sniper fire during a trip to Tuzla, Bosnia in 1996. "I remember landing under sniper fire," she said gravely in a speech at George Washington University in March 2008. "There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles to get to our base." Mrs. Clinton told the gripping story in her 2003 autobiography and resurrected it during the 2008 campaign stops in Dubuque, Iowa, Waco, Texas, and Washington, D.C. to illustrate her bravery, fortitude, expertise, and massive foreign policy experience edge over Barack Obama. But she left a few details out. Along with her on the dangerous mission, her then-teenage daughter Chelsea, entertainer Sinbad, and singer Sheryl Crow, and oh yeah, there was 8-year-old Bosnian girl Amina Bikacic, who calmly embraced the intrepid First Lady and read her a poem on the tarmac, while a huge contingent of children and parents and other onlookers surrounded them with not the least bit of concern about flying bullets. After Sinbad, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Daily News, and every fact checker on the internet and under the sun had debunked her tall tale, Senator Clinton doubled down. Asked about how perilous the trip was, Sinbad cracked, "I think the only red phone moment was, do we eat here or at the next place?" A miffed Mrs. Clinton dismissed Sinbad as a mere comedian. She asserted again that she and her compatriots ran for safety with our heads down. She clung to her story that she had to be moved inside because of sniper fire, and she embellished further. There was no greeting ceremony, and we were basically told to run to our cars. Now that is what happened. When a video of the cheery greeting ceremony surfaced in March 2008, showing no such thing, Hillary's excuses poured forth. She misspoke. Besides, she poo-pooed, "I say a lot of things, millions of words a day, so if I misspoke, that was just a misstatement." She sniffed that her Tuzla hustle was just a minor blip. Finally, Hillary blamed her congenital dissembling on being sleep-deprived. If that is so, then Hillary has been a walking zombie for years. This is the woman who insisted for more than a decade that she was named after the late great mountain climber Sir Edmund Hillary. Never mind that she was born 6 years before he became famous for scaling Mount Everest in 1953. Her husband repeated the lie in his 2004 autobiography. Mrs. Clinton finally admitted it was untrue in 2006 when she blamed it on her mother. This is the woman who claimed to have helped to start the federal Children's Health Insurance Program. Never mind that the program's original sponsors noted that Senator Clinton fought the initial bill and had no role in writing the legislation. This is the woman echoed by her husband and daughter, who bragged that she was the first to call the disaster in Darfur genocide. Never mind that several other senators had done so in 2004, while her press statement referring to Darfur as genocide wasn't until March 2006. This is the woman who claimed to have organized instrumental meetings in Belfast, Ireland, and boldly asserted that she helped to bring peace to Northern Ireland. Never mind that key negotiators dismissed her as totally invisible, cheerleading, and a wee bit silly. This is the chronic sufferer of the truth deficit disorder whom President Obama, with the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate, has entrusted to conduct good faith negotiations on foreign affairs and put America's interests above all else. Feeling queasy yet? Transparency and two for the price of one. I think I'm probably the most transparent person in public life, Senator Hillary Clinton asserted in 2008. To borrow a trademark Clintonian phrase, it all depends on what the meaning of transparent is. Her insatiable ambition is as see-through as a Britney Spears top, but her commitment to openness in government earns a big fat F. It took a public disclosure lawsuit by Washington, D.C.-based Judicial Watch to force Mrs. Clinton to release thousands of pages from her schedules while serving as First Lady. The group also successfully filed suit to obtain records regarding Mrs. Clinton's secret health care task force, including internal memos detailing the creation of a government interest group database to collect personal information on interest group leaders, such as their home phone numbers, addresses, biographies, analysis of credibility in the media, and known relationships with Congress people. For years, the Clintons refused to disclose donors to the Clinton Presidential Library. The Washington Post called the Clintons' lack of full disclosure outrageous, noting that presidential libraries, though built and endowed with private funds, are public property run by the National Archives. The public has a right to know who's underwriting them. To the best of my knowledge, I didn't take money from anybody. I shouldn't have, former President Clinton said, in explaining why the public should simply trust his judgment instead of opening the books. In 2004, a New York Sun reporter accessed a public touchscreen computer terminal at the facility that produced a list of donors to the $165 million compound. The Sun reported that in addition to the infamous $450,000 gift from pardon seeker Mark Rich's ex-wife, donations included gifts of $1 million or more each from the Saudi royal family and three Saudi businessmen, as well as $1 million plus each contributions from the governments of Dubai, Kuwait, and Qatar, and the Deputy Prime Minister of Lebanon. After the Sun's article appeared, the list of donors available on the library's computer terminal disappeared. For years, the Clintons refused to disclose their full income tax forms. It took her rival-turned-boss Barack Obama's full IRS document disclosure to force Hillary to follow suit in April 2008. The tax documents, covering 2000 to 2007, revealed the Clintons' get-rich windfall of approximately $111 million in total income over that time period. Their income increased by nearly 50 times in the first year after Bill Clinton left office, the Politico reported, highlighting the lucrative opportunities awaiting former presidents. For years, the couple refused to disclose donors to the former president's mega charity, the William J. Clinton Foundation, described by the Chronicle of Philanthropy as one of the most successful fundraising organizations in the United States. It took Mrs. Clinton's Secretary of State nomination to force this treasure trove of foreign conflicts of interest to be dislodged. But even this belated, reluctant gesture was incomplete. To close the deal on the nomination, the Clintons released a public list of past donors to the foundation and signed a memorandum of understanding with the Obama transition team, agreeing to disclose new donors once a year. Foreign government donations will be reviewed by State Department ethics officials. Former President Clinton agreed to step down as the public face of the Clinton Foundation and break off a separate program, the Clinton Global Initiative. Mrs. Clinton called her disclosure agreement unprecedented in its scope and cited government reviews concluding that there is not an inherent conflict of interest in any of my husband's work at all. But through thick and thin, through hell and high water, through stained blue dresses and purple fits of rage, Bill and Hillary Clinton are joined at the hip. As GOP Senator Richard Lugar put it while pondering how to disentangle their cosmic ties and conflicted interests, I don't know, frankly. I would just suspect that given all of the ties, all of the influence that he has, all of the relationships, that he is a major player in foreign policy. Now, Mrs. Clinton is going to be the Secretary of State. They are married. They are a team. Like they promised in 1992, America gets two for the price of one with the Clintons, no matter which of them is in office. Cosmic ties. The Clinton Foundation donor list did not provide precise amounts, dates of the donations, or background information on the donor's employers. Non-governmental foreign sources were not and will not be disclosed. But among the information that the Clintons did not disclose was the donation of up to $5 million to the Clinton Foundation from one Gilbert Chigori, a Lebanese businessman born in Nigeria who calls himself an economic advisor to Benin and a UNESCO ambassador to St. Lucia. He also happens to be a scandal-tainted operative who was tight with Nigerian General Sani Abacha, a dictator who seized power in a coup in the 1990s. In 2001, Chigori forked over $300 million to the Nigerian government to get rid of a pesky probe into charges that billions of dollars had been improperly siphoned out of Nigeria during the Abacha regime. During those years, Harper's Magazine reported, Chigori received oil concessions and large-scale government construction contracts and allegedly offered Abacha help with his financial affairs. And during that time, Chigori used his wealth to insinuate himself into the Clinton White House and the Democrat Party, arranging a $100,000 speaking fee for Clinton at a Caribbean event and pitching in $460,000 for a Miami-based voter registration drive backed by the Democratic National Committee. For his quid, the foreign national Chigori enjoyed many quos. The Wall Street Journal reported that Chigori attended Clinton's 60th birthday bash in New York and joined the former president at a gala wedding party in France for a top Clinton aide. For her part, Mrs. Clinton received thousands of dollars in donations from stateside relatives of Chigori, including Michael Chigorai, identified as a bundler who raised at least $100,000 for Hillary, and several other donors who maxed out with $4,600 in individual contributions using the names Chigori or Chigori or Chamchom. The latter is the maiden name of Gilbert Chigori's wife. Another wealthy donor listed as giving up to $5 million to the Clinton Foundation, billionaire Viktor Pinchuk, the son-in-law of former Ukrainian strongman Leonid Kuchma. The steel company magnate was fingered in several sweetheart deals and accused by Ukrainian reformers of crony capitalism. In 2006, he settled a lawsuit that accused him of bribing officials of a mega iron alloy producer, skimming $41 million in profits, and wrongfully diverting other funds worth an estimated $500 million. Sidling up to former President Clinton helped burnish Pinchuk's philanthropic credentials. After donating millions to Clinton's anti-poverty and AIDS programs, Pinchuk was warmly received at the inauguration of the Clinton Library in Little Rock and at Clinton's 60th birthday bash. No word on whether Chigori and Pinchuk ran into each other. More worrisome for Hillary, her husband displayed abysmal judgment in 2007 while she was running for president when he flew to Yalta to join his pal Pinchuk. At a conference on the future of Ukraine, former President Clinton embraced a tainted symbol of the troubled corruptocracy's recent past, Newsweek reported. Clinton dazzled the audience with a powerful address about the global challenges facing Ukraine. But he also inadvertently caused a stir when he was embraced by Pinchuk's father-in-law, Ukraine's former president, Leonid Kuchma, whose authoritarian rule had been condemned by the State Department. 3 years ago, a Ukrainian government investigation linked Kuchma's regime to the decapitation in 2000 of dissident journalist Gheorghe Gundgadze. When Gundgadze's widow, Miroslava, saw a newspaper photo of Clinton and Kuchma at the conference, "I wanted to throw up," she told Newsweek. Clinton, she says, was being used by Pinchuk to clean up and legitimize Kuchma's legacy. A Clinton spokesman declined to comment on the ex-president's encounter with Kuchma. Gungadze's death was no obscure historical blip. The investigative internet reporter found mutilated in a shallow grave was an intrepid critic of Kuchma's corruption. His grisly murder sparked the Orange Revolution that swept Kuchma out of power. Kuchma's own former bodyguard released audio tapes with a voice identified as Kuchma's conspiring to harm the journalist. Gungadze's wife and two children won political asylum in the U.S. and have lived here since 2001. In March 2008, three former police officers were convicted of Gungazi's murder, and a former Interior Ministry chief of Kuchma's is still wanted for his role in plotting the crime. After observing the November 21, 2004 elections in Ukraine as an election monitor, Senator Lugar, then chair of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, reported that the government of President Kuchma allowed, or aided and abetted, wholesale fraud and abuse that changed the results of the election. Widespread physical intimidation of voters and illegal use of governmental, administrative, and legal authorities were persistent throughout the campaign. Yet 3 years later, Bill Clinton lent his name and fame to the Yalta summit organized by Kuchma's wealthy son-in-law and top contributor to the Clinton Foundation and attended by Kuchma himself. In addition to all that foreign funny money, the Clinton Foundation received $10 million to $25 million from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and a total of at least $46 million from foreign governments, including Norway, Kuwait, Qatar, Brunei, Oman, Italy, Jamaica, and the Dutch National Lottery, which pitched in $5 million to $10 million. Israeli business executives, the Blackwater Private Security Company, oil, gas, and mining interests were all represented on the list as well. The Associated Press broke down more of the donor info, incomplete as it was, which was posted on the Clinton Foundation website. Saudi businessman Nasir al-Rashid gave between $1 million to $5 million. So did two private entities, Friends of Saudi Arabia and the Dubai Foundation. Amar Singh, another donor in the $1 million to $5 million category, is an Indian politician who hosted Bill Clinton on a visit to India in 2005 and met Hillary Clinton in New York in September to discuss an India-U.S. civil nuclear agreement. Tulsi Tanti, a wealthy executive also from India, chairs a wind turbine company that donated up to $5 million. He unveiled plans for a $5 billion project to develop environmentally friendly power generation in India and China. AusAid, the Australian government's overseas aid program, and Copresida, Secretariado Técnico, a Dominican Republic government agency formed to fight AIDS, each gave $10 million to $25 million. Copresida benefited from an export-import bank loan at the 11th hour of the Clinton administration, according to a watchdog group, which also wondered why would a cash-strapped AIDS agency accused of mismanagement in a country of 9.5 million give President Clinton one of his largest donations to do the same thing it is trying to do, collect money and redistribute for AIDS projects. AIDS patients protested that the agency had failed to build long-promised treatment centers and failed to expand treatment access. China Overseas Real Estate Development and the U.S. Islamic World Conference gave $250,000 to $500,000 each. GOP Senator Lugar stated the obvious at Mrs. Clinton's Senate confirmation hearing. The core of the problem is that foreign governments and entities may perceive the Clinton Foundation as a means to gain favor with the Secretary of State, although neither Senator Clinton nor President Clinton has a personal financial stake in the foundation. Obviously, its work benefits their legacy and their public service priorities. There's nothing wrong with this, and President Clinton is deservedly proud of the Clinton Foundation's good work in addressing HIV/AIDS, global poverty, climate change, and other pressing problems. But the Clinton Foundation exists as a temptation for any foreign entity or government that believes it could curry favor through a donation. It also sets up potential perception problems with any action taken by the Secretary of State in relation to foreign givers or their countries. The nature of the Secretary of State post makes recusal from specific policy decisions almost impossible, since even localized U.S. foreign policy activities can ripple across countries and continents. Every new foreign donation that is accepted by the Foundation comes with the risk that it will be connected in the global media to approximate State Department policy or decision. Foreign perceptions are incredibly important to U.S. foreign policy, and mistaken impressions or suspicions can deeply affect the actions of foreign governments toward the United States. Moreover, we do not want our own government's deliberations distracted by avoidable controversies played out in the media. The bottom line is that even well-intentioned foreign donations carry risks for U.S. foreign policy. The only certain way to eliminate this risk going forward is for the Clinton Foundation to forswear new foreign contributions when Senator Clinton becomes Secretary of State. Senator Clinton rejected that call and adamantly refused to take reasonable measures proposed by Senator Lugar to achieve true transparency, including provisions to immediately report all gifts of $50,000 or more and all such donations from foreigners at the time they are pledged, and a requirement to review all donations above $50,000 from individual and corporate foreign sources, not just foreign governments. For an administration that had committed itself to full transparency, it's a disappointing way to start, the New York Post sighed. Indeed, the Clintons' ethical baggage, past, present, and future, is now Barack Obama's burden. Adventures in Kazakhstan. Hillary's hubby has left no international cash behind. Among his thorniest dalliances is his relationship with mining financier Frank Giustra. The Canadian tycoon flew Clinton in his private corporate jet to meet with Kazakhstan's authoritarian ruler, Nursultan Nazarbayev, in 2005. The New York Times reported that the trio enjoyed a sumptuous midnight banquet. Clinton endorsed Nazarbayev's lip service to fair elections, despite official State Department condemnations of his repressive tactics. Giustra won lucrative agreements with the country's state-owned uranium agency. And the Clinton Foundation's coffers swelled after the deal, turning an unknown shell company into one of the world's largest uranium producers in a transaction ultimately worth tens of millions of dollars to Mr. Giustra, analysts said, was sealed. After showering more than $130 million on Clinton's charity, the Times reported, Giustra secured a place in Mr. Clinton's inner circle, an exclusive club of wealthy entrepreneurs in which friendship with the former president has its privileges. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton insists her husband's interests pose no inherent conflict for her, but Giustra's reach is global. How could there not be the appearance of a conflict of interest in any policy decision the State Department might make in the countries where Giustra operates or plans to operate?